Welcome to today's episode of The Power of Reinvention. Here we talk with my guests about the dreams, the visions, and the passions that individuals have every day and dare to explore them. Whether it's business or personal, you're entitled to live the life that you want, and no matter what the circumstances, you have the power to create success, fulfill your dreams, and live with passion. That's what I'm talking about. So dare greatly and happy reinventing, folks. Hi, and welcome to The Power of Reinvention. I am so excited to have with me today my guest, Dori Clark, who is a reinvention expert, an extraordinary businesswoman with incredible accolades. I'm actually going to share a bit of her bio in just a moment. But welcome, Dori. Thank you for being here.
Kathy, thank you. It's great to connect.
I'm excited to have Dori as my guest because we have just so much going on right now in our worlds about trying to figure out how to reinvent, where our best use of time is, what we want to really be doing with our life, our time, our business, our personal space, everything that's going on. And as many of you may know that have been listening to this podcast for quite some time, I launched a book called Reinvent Your Life, What Are You Waiting For? On March 7th of 2020, ironically, the week before we were all told to go home. And, you know, I sort of had to sit back and really reinvent the book launch plan. That was not in my plans, but ironically, it sort of became the ultimate guidebook for what everybody was going through. People were being forced or invited, as depends on your perspective and your life, to reinvent some part of your life. And so it became a really incredible opportunity to have the conversations with friends and colleagues and business partners and experts in all kinds of areas about what we were all dealing with. Now, of course, I started writing this book long before we ever knew there was such a thing as a pandemic and did not expect that that was the audience that I would be catering to. And so it is an evergreen conversation. It's clearly something that, Dori, you have been dealing with and involved with for quite some time. And I'm just delighted to have a really robust chat with you today about everything that, you know, we've all been going through for a couple of years, but really the bigger picture and how do we live this one beautiful life of ours in the way we possibly can. So we're going to dive in a moment. I'm just going to share a little background on you for real quick for those who don't know. Dori helps individuals and companies get their best ideas heard in a crowded, noisy world. She's been named one of the top 50 business thinkers in the world by Thinkers 50. She was honored as the number one communication coach in the world by the Marshall Goldsmith Leading Global Coaches Awards and one of the top 5 communication professionals in the world by Global Gurus. She's a keynote speaker and teaches executive education for Duke University's Fuqua School of Business and Columbia Business School. She is a Wall Street Journal bestselling author of The Long Game, Entrepreneurial You, Reinventing You, and Stand Out, which was named the number one leadership book of the year by Inc. magazine. She has been described by the New York Times as an expert at self-reinvention and helping others make changes in their lives. She's also a frequent contributor to the Harvard Business Review, and you can download her free Long Game Strategic Thinking Self-Assessment at doriclark.com/thelonggame. And I'm going to put all of that in our show notes. So if you heard that and went, wait, I didn't catch that. Don't worry. It's in the show notes. Just go take a look. And, you know, I just have to add to that. There is so much. I mean, your website is so robust with so much incredible information and tools. You've got the assessment tool there. You've got access to your books, your TED Talk. I mean, Dori's been doing this for a while, folks. So listen in to all that she has to say. Hi there.
Kathy, thank you so much. I'm really glad to talk with you today.
Absolutely. So Dori, I want to take you back. This is kind of one of my funnest questions to start with. Who was little Dori? And what was it that you thought you would be doing with your life when you were maybe 5 or 10 or 15 years old and had some notion of what your life may hold or may not have held for you? And where you are today. So what was your story and who was little Dori?
Well, when I was really a little Dory, I was extremely obsessed with James Bond, and I wanted to be a spy. And
that
didn't work out in a literal sense. But one of my other projects, which is not among the ones that you listed, but is important to me, is I have spent the past 6 years learning to write musical theater. And so I have written I describe it as a sexy lesbian spy thriller musical. And it is basically about, you know, if James Bond were a woman. And I have been working assiduously to try to get it to advance. And it actually just won second place in a national search for new musicals competition led by NMI, which is out of your hometown of Los Angeles.
Yeah, I was going to say, we've got the Hollywood hookups over here, my friend. We might have to talk about that offline. I love that.
Amazing.
What an amazing concept. And, you know, I think so often we watch films and shows and movies and series, especially with the plethora of streaming networks now, there's just so much content, and you just kind of look at things and you're like, okay, it's all been done. You've got something really different here. I love that. Well, let's hope that someone out there is listening to this, and we'll have to chat about that as well. So what was your sort of trajectory from, you know, where you were as a kid and sort of leaning into the first stages of your professional career, what you thought you wanted to do? How did you end up where you are today?
Well, in the earliest days of my career, I had a lot of setbacks and sort of inadvertent being just, you know, kicked out on my behind and having to figure things out. I got my first job as a reporter at a small newspaper in Boston. I was a political reporter, and I ended up getting laid off after about a year of working there. And they laid me off on Monday, September 10th, 2001. So it was a very inauspicious day the next day to begin my job hunt. And so I kind of scrambled around. I was a freelance writer after that. I then I couldn't actually get another job in journalism. So I went to work on political campaigns, and I became the press secretary for a governor's race. I became the communications director on a presidential race. They were both really exciting experiences, but we lost both races. So I had a lot of things that didn't quite work out early on, but taught me interesting lessons, and I was able to bundle them later to help my experience as an entrepreneur. And I've been working for myself now for the past 16 years.
And it's funny, I bet at the time you didn't realize the value of who you were meeting, who was in your sort of sphere of influence, what you were doing. I mean, when you talk about being a press secretary and sort of, you know, I immediately think of the Rolodex, the databases, as we now call it, of people and relationships that today, doing what you're doing, you've probably been able to go back to and say, hey, remember me, remember when? And, you know, at the time, you don't realize the value of that. And yet, as we grow older, and I like to say now that I'm older and wiser and have a much deeper Rolodex of relationships, you know, you really get to understand the value of what you may have been doing in the moment, but at the time maybe did not completely recognize, right?
Sure, absolutely. How did you get your start with, you know, creating your agency, Kathy? What was your arc?
I literally, I love this question because A, it's funny, I'm the one asking the questions, but we can turn it around. I actually started my business almost out of college. And
wow.
I just decided I wanted to have my own thing. I had a sister who was in the PR business. I worked for her for a little while. I worked for a little while for a woman who had a single person agency. So I kind of, you know, cut my teeth on a bit of that experience. But within about 2 years of graduating college, I was like, well, you know, I get this. I know what I want to do. I get how it works. I was bold enough at the age of 24 to think I knew what I was doing, right? And I literally said, I'm going to hang up my own shingle. And I kind of just went there. And it's funny, I say this a lot in rooms today, especially with women's organizations and women's groups. There's so much support and so much validation and so much strength in the power of women's organizations that are holding up and supporting women and encouraging these conversations. But back then, there were none. That didn't exist. So I just kind of, there was no should I, shouldn't I, I'm a woman, what's everybody going to say, can I ask for this much money versus a man? That did not exist in my brain. So I recognized my value and said, this is what I'm going to build and create. And I just did it.
Which way is to go.
Kind of unusual, because the conversation supports those who question it today, but it also creates the question of doubt. It creates the question of there's actually an option. I never knew there was an option. I just said, this is what it is. This is what I'm doing. And hey, this is what we charge, or this is how, you know. So it's a very interesting dynamic. So I just kind of leaned into what I loved, what I was passionate about. And you know how they say, if you love something, just really lean into it and you'll figure out how to make the money. Well, that's kind of what I did, but only I didn't know that that was a thing. I just kind of did it. But I really grew the business from there. And, you know, enough about me.
Nice try,
but we're going back to you. But I would love to sort of ask the same question of you, really, Dori. Like, how did you build the business from where you were at that point that you just referenced before, where you became a freelancer, you're working on these projects, but you have now really built out this incredible advisory business and, you know, authored several books. So what sort of really empowered you to go there?
So early on, I think like any entrepreneur, my first clients were people that I already knew. You know, they were the people who were willing to take a chance on me, even though I didn't have any experience doing this thing, because I had worked with them in other capacities and they knew I was decent in general. But the main problem that I faced early on was that because my work had been in journalism and in politics and then later in nonprofits, I did not actually have a lot, by which I mean any, people in the corporate world who would hire me. And so I was working for these like very, very scrappy organizations that had tiny budgets. So early on, I was doing basically anything and everything for like, oh, you'll pay me $500. Okay, great. Yeah. And so just really hustling and piecing things together. So, you know, I was able to get work for sure. But I think the big challenge, which was a multi-year process, and I knew that it needed to happen, was figuring out how to build out my network so that I was meeting the kinds of people who would ultimately be able to hire me for different and better fees. And I had to be quite strategic about that. I mean, it involved doing, you know, everything from, you know, signing up to attend conferences, a lot of conferences where I knew I would meet the right people, to right. embarking on a campaign of really starting to write for high profile publications so that I could try to attract people in to me. But I started out really not knowing anybody in the corporate sphere and recognizing that was a weakness I had to correct.
So that's were these kind of those aha moments that I call them, where you have this epiphany, right? You're in a room, you realize what you do or don't know, who you do or don't know, what you should or should not be striving for. You know, people talk a lot about imposter syndrome, but, you know, for me, it's sort of not really an imposter syndrome. It's aspiring to be and do something and showing up and being and doing that, and then being able to really fulfill yourself with what it takes to be and do that. What were some of those aha moments for you, where that was maybe a catalyst or an catalyst moment or an inflection point, as we call it, you know, that really sort of changed things or the trajectory that you were on?
Well, I think there's a number of possibilities I can talk about. One, which was sort of a big one, was I was starting my business in 2006. And that was a kind of impactful year because it was right when social media was sort of starting to become something. 2006 was when YouTube was invented. Facebook was not even yet a thing. I think it may have been invented, but it was still on college campuses. But you know, Twitter was just launching. So it was 2007, 2008 when social media became really a phenomenon that everybody was like, you know, what is this? We don't understand this. We have to figure this out. And so that was one strand. And the other strand was that the old world of PR, and I mean, I'm sure you know this even better than I do, but all of a sudden, just incredibly rapidly, the news hole was shrinking, as they say. Yeah. And, yeah, you know, reporters were being shed left and right. The paper itself was getting smaller. And so there was this, you know, maybe you experienced this as well, Kathy. There was this huge disparity in expectations because, you know, when I was starting, I kind of evolved into marketing strategy, but that was a little bit of a conscious decision because I was originally doing a lot of PR work and clients would be getting mad at me because they were no longer getting in the paper for things they used to get in the paper about. Right. I'm like, have you noticed the paper is 60% smaller? And it was just so demoralizing.
Yeah.
So I shifted the focus.
You know, yes.
Sounds like you feel my pain.
I so feel your pain. And honestly, it's funny because, you know, you asked sort of how I got started and doing what I was doing. So my company was purely a PR agency when I started out. And it evolved into PR and marketing. And then I literally pulled the PR piece out of it. And it was out of necessity. It's exactly what you're talking about. Also, as the clients were looking at us and they were getting upset that they weren't getting the coverage, my comeback to them was, let's face it, is that New York Times story or that piece on the TV show really moving the needle on your business? And if you really want us to get to work and make your business thrive, let's look at 20 other things we should be doing, not just the story in the paper. Like the story in the paper should cover the fabulous things that we're actually doing that are clever and smart and partnership marketing and all these other events and things that we've started to do for them. So it was kind of a catalyst for us to pivot and sort of go, okay, if that's not working so well over there with the media because of all those reasons you just stated, what else can we do? And that's what grew our business. So it was opportunistic in a way, but not an easy time.
Yes, absolutely. So yeah, it was a very transitional time. And so I needed to shift the focus of what I was doing as a result of that, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It sounds like you did as well. So good for you.
Yeah, exactly. You know, God knows if we'd met each other way back then, what we'd be doing together at this point. So that's kind of a fun thought. So for you, in terms of really what you're doing today and where the strength really lies and how you're servicing your clients and the brands and the companies that you're doing business with, what would you say is really the sweet spot of what it is that you do and that what you share and deliver to folks and to companies?
Yeah, these days, I would say primarily my work is speaking, doing keynote speaking. And so I've written 4 books, and a lot of my work is giving talks about various facets of that. My latest one, as you were mentioning, is The Long Game, How to Be a Long-Term Thinker in a Short-Term World. So there is, thankfully, for my purposes, a lot of focus post-COVID on strategy and setting your strategy and what should your strategy be and how can we actually get back to long-term thinking. And so I think that that's a fairly relevant topic these days. So I've been speaking about that a lot. I, over the years, have done a lot of things in the career space, you could say. So companies will bring me in, you know, for career week or career month or what have you, because a lot of my work is around personal brand and specifically around the question of just how do you make sure that other people are fully appreciating you? You have talents, you have abilities, and most people don't really care that much. They're just not paying very close attention.
Right.
And so how do we get them to notice? Because they need to notice in order for you to have access to opportunities, but you have to thread the needle to do it in a way that is smart and not off-putting. And so I speak a lot for companies about that question so that employees basically can step up and empower themselves to be able to access the opportunities they want.
So I have two questions that come out of that, actually, sort of like want to go in this direction and that direction, but two things. One is, could you provide some specifics for people who are trying to figure out how to really hone in on their personal brand? And part two to that question is, how do you do that in a non-threatening environment within a company? And I kind of run into this, so it's sort of a, you know, I have my own answer for this, and I'm curious to know how you deal with this, which I'm sure you do a lot. You are speaking to individuals in a company environment, and your goal is not to say, hey, go leave the company and go create your own brand and be your own thing. And, you know, that's, they're never going to invite you back to the company again. But how do you encourage people to find their voice and their true brand and thrive within those companies? And so, you know, I'd love to sort of go to question one first of all, and then sort of segue, if you can, into that. Like, what are some of the, you know, top 3-5 kind of tips, if you will, that really give people an idea of how to sort of start to focus on their personal brand?
Sure. So when it comes to the question of sort of identifying your personal brand, and, you know, and some people don't even like the term, it's fine. You don't have to use the term. I mean, really what it means, it's kind of a modern term of art, but it's basically what is your reputation? And is your reputation what you would want your reputation to be? Which I think is terminology that most people can listen to and realize, oh yeah, that actually would be helpful. So I think one starting point is that it's generally fairly hard for us as individuals to understand what is distinctive about us. That's the problem, is that we know too much about ourselves. We are in our heads so much, we know all the things. And the challenge arises from the fact that other people don't know all the things and they really don't care about all the things. For them, looking from the outside at you, they are noticing probably 3 big things, let's say. Like not that many. I mean, it's basically like, oh, he's smart and he's tall. And he likes lacrosse, you know, like that's sort of the extent of it. And so how do we make sure with like that limited of a palette that people are thinking the right thing about us? This is crucial. So anyway, the first starting point is that it is very useful to understand what actually they're already thinking, because we can work with that sometimes, you know, there might be something actually that's legitimately good that you're not appreciating. I did a session once with clients, and it was so interesting because, you know, it was a small group of people that knew each other pretty well. And it was kind of a workshop. And so they're like, we want to try this. So they picked one guy, they sent him out of the room, and they all wrote down 3 words to describe him. And then they brought him back in and read him the 3 words. And 7 of the 10 people, one of their top 3 words for him was creative. And I thought it was so powerful, because if you had asked this guy, you know, yes or no, are you creative? I mean, obviously he'd probably be like, yeah, I am. But I guarantee you, he did not understand that 70% of the people who knew him best thought it was one of his defining characteristics. So sometimes just asking a small group of people, this is something I talk about in my book, Reinventing You, can be very powerful to sort of get that sense of like, well, what is it that people think is most unique? Like that's really useful. You know, at a really basic level, one of the strategies that I often share is there are a lot of really low hanging fruit that we're not tapping here. A very basic thing. Anytime you see somebody that you have not seen for a while, you know, in a professional context, in a personal context, inevitably there will be a question asked that is some variation of, what have you been up to? Right? Like, you know, we know this is happening, and yet we fail to prepare for it. And if we only prepared, you could use that instead of being like, blah, 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 I don't know, same old, same old. You could use that to actually say something relevant to how you would like to be known. If you want to be known as a more strategic thinker, you could say, oh gosh, I've just been reading this really interesting book about strategy. You know, I noticed blah, 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 blah. Or you could say, oh wow, well, I've been you know, really involved with a nonprofit that I serve on. I'm the head of the strategic planning committee, and we've been doing X and Y and Z. And it begins to seep into people's minds. So those would be a couple of pieces that I might suggest.
I love that. And, I always get goosebumps, Dory, because I feel like there are so many things that, for those of us who know and understand, are very obvious. And many people do struggle with that. They struggle with that moment. They don't quite know. I think social media has helped a lot of people try to put a lens on themselves. And I think naturally that's not our inclination, to be self-promoting or to be able to feel comfortable talking about ourselves. But it's not braggadocious to sort of be able to communicate what you do, what you're passionate about, what you've been up to, and finding, to your point, being prepared, finding the words and the language that perhaps do give you that. You know, and it's one thing to be at a high school reunion versus, you know, a business conference and who you're in a room with and how you may answer that question. But I think those are some really interesting things. That notion of just be prepared is so just critical to have people having a better understanding. I think a lot of people may have put up a LinkedIn profile about themselves 10 years ago and have a thought to go back and look at and take a look at it and maybe update it. And what have been the ideals or the values that might have shifted in us in the last 3, 4, 5 years, and where we might be able to sort of change the vernacular a little bit or update that photo a little bit, or, you know, really just kind of think about it from that perspective. I really appreciate what you said. The other piece of that question being, you know, how do you go into these companies and encourage people to, you know, sort of, and I think you partially answer that in what you just said, you know, it's like, I do strategy. If you're doing something within a company, how do you encourage people to stay put where they are because they want to or need to financially in the business world, but reinvent some part of their life so that they feel the joy, the newness, the freshness, the stimulation, the curiosity? Where do you sort of advise or guide folks who come to you with those questions?
Yeah, well, you certainly raise a good point, Kathy. And I know that, you know, I wrote my first book, Reinventing You, 10 years ago now. And so back when I was first starting, and I'm sure that, you know, you with a similar topic, you hear the same thing. You know, sometimes people would be like, but what if they reinvent themselves right out of their job? What if they decide they want to leave? And it's like, I mean, the really great
just like
thing,
that.
Yeah, exactly. The really great thing, I mean, I guess if you can call it this, post COVID, sorry, they're like already leaving. They're already going.
Yeah.
And so it's not like anything that Dory Clark says is gonna like really, you know, plant an idea in their head that somehow wasn't there already.
Yeah, you just given that extra support of validation.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the crucial thing that employers, I think, has always been true, but employers are absolutely recognizing now is, wait a minute. People, if they want to leave, they are going to leave. And what we can do, and a lot of what I do, I mean, I think, you know, part of why people bring me in to speak at companies is understanding that that actually the antidote that corporations have at their disposal, if they want to keep their people, you know, you can't really keep them by coercion anymore. I mean, people are just leaving in droves. It's part of the zeitgeist. The way that you can keep your people is to actually ensure that they like what they're doing, that they feel fulfilled with what they're doing. And if they are not feeling fulfilled right at the moment, then the best thing that you can do is to hopefully give them the tools that they need so that they can raise their hand and say, hey, I'd like to try something different. Or, hey, I'd like to experiment with this. I'd like to take this training. I'd like to take this course. I mean, people, you know, often, I know you know, but you know, in the popular imagination, people often fail to understand that companies really want employees to be proactive about saying, hey, can I blah, 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 or I would like to blah, 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 because the standard career pathways have just have blown up. You know, there's not escalators anymore. And if somebody is not happy, if they're not enjoying what they're doing, if they feel like they have a contribution to make that's not being tapped, the company may not know about it. They may not hear about it. They're, you know, we'd love to think that a very engaged manager would be, you know, totally tapped in, but, you know, that may not be the case. Yeah. And so if we can have employees that have the tools to seek out and ask for and get what they want, they're far more likely to want to stay and to be performing at a top level. So I think by now, the conversation around reinvention, I think that most companies understand that it's a very pro-company thing. It's a very pro-corporate thing because this is the symbiotic, very win-win way that they can be retaining talent. Do you agree with that?
No, 1,000%. And it's a dialogue I have a lot. I likewise do keynotes and speak to companies, and I'm brought in and I ask the question because, you know, I often speak to people, you know, we don't want them to reinvent themselves out of the company. And the certainly, you know, the person that's invited you to come speak to the company doesn't want you to come in and say, hey, tell all my people to leave. But how do you find the passion points in your daily life? And it doesn't have to be work related, first of all. It can be what you do before, at lunchtime, after work, and every other part of your life that just makes you so fulfilled. And I have a great story in my book about the man with the violin. He worked at a major toy company. We happened to meet on a plane. He's carrying a case with him. And I was being nosy on the plane. And I said, what's in the case? And he said, it's my violin. I said, we're going to the licensing show in Las Vegas. Like, why are you taking your violin? Like, is there a toy in there? What, you know, what's in there? And he says, well, I actually leave at lunchtime every day at work and I go to the park across the street and I play the violin.
Wow.
And I said, well, that's fascinating. I said, well, have you done this your whole life? He goes, no, I just decided a year ago that I wanted to learn how to play. So I went to a secondhand store and I bought a violin and I went on YouTube and I taught myself how to play. And I go across the street at lunchtime every day and I practice playing while I'm in the park. So I don't like disturb people. And obviously people at this point, he was probably good enough to somewhat entertain people, I hope. And I said, and you're taking this to Vegas. Why? He goes, well, typically when I'm in a hotel, I'll ask for an empty meeting room and I'll go down there and I'll just practice. But that's where I get so much joy and fulfillment. And that was such an aha moment for me. And this was probably 5 years into like the working on the book, like the epiphany, the idea, the blogs, the, all the things I was doing before I was really in like hardcore book mode. And I said, my God, this is my poster child. Like that story right there is one that more people need to hear and be aware of, that there are so many other places in our life that bring us joy and fulfill us, that you may not love your 9-to-6 job and God forbid you're in that predicament, but there are so many other ways to not let that weigh down the rest of your life. And I think that's important. The other being sort of what you were just saying, that, you know, if you communicate to your manager, your boss, whoever it is in your work environment, that you have an interest in writing or an interest in photography or an interest in content creation, and that's not your kind of day job, but you'd like to be in on some of those meetings or be a part of that team, or perhaps in your free time, you can add this one, X, Y, and Z. You know, you're opening up the possibility that you can, in fact, shift what's happening internally and within the company. And, you know, I think more people need to realize that you are entitled, and that is a big word that I use in the world of reinvention, that if we understand that we are entitled to live the life that we want, then we now are giving ourselves permission to explore all of these conversations.
Yes, love that.
Yeah. So are you living your true north? Do you feel that you are doing exactly what you want to be doing right now? Is this a stepping stone to the next wow part of chapter of your life?
Well, you know, I feel pretty darn self-actualized. Yeah, I've been doing some cool things. I mean, it was certainly always a dream of mine to write books and, you know, to get to have an impact in that way, you know, sort of sharing the content, the ideas that I've created. And something that I talk about in the long game is applying the benefits of applying Google's 20% time to our own lives. You know, sort of popularly, Google a number of years ago had a policy where they called it 20% time, where they encouraged employees to spend up to 20% of their time on kind of more speculative long-term activities that may or may not pan out. And I think it's a very good idea for individuals as well, regular people, to just make that time. And so for me, I've really allocated a lot of that over the past 6 years to writing musical theater. And, you know, the kind of interesting thing is that 20% of your time is a great number, because if it all goes horribly awry, it's not so much time that you've like ruined your life or turned yourself bankrupt. Like you got other stuff going on, you'll be fine. But if things actually start to pan out, 20% of your time over a period of years is actually kind of a lot of time. And so you can actually make legitimate progress towards something.
Yeah, no, it's true. And I love that, you know, the idea that focusing on that and understanding that enables you to really practice that. You talk about we're all so busy. We always feel so busy all the time. I am the poster child, and I hear my son saying it every day now. Oh, Mom, I'm so busy. I've got so much going on. I'm like, is that what I've always sounded like? Like, ew. Like, I'm really hearing myself in him now. And I'm like, that is not a good thing. Exactly. I wish. 26 now, right? Entrepreneur, his own business. Oh, I'm so busy. I'm so busy. But are you smart? Are you working smart? You know, how busy are you? And just that notion of it sounds so important to be busy. No, it just sounds really bad. Like, we're all busy. So that sort of busyness of our lives, and how do we not be so busy, and how do we kind of reprioritize what we're really doing and how we're doing it? You speak a lot about that. What are some of your thoughts there?
Yeah, thank you, Kathy. I do talk about this quite a bit in the long game, and I did a TEDx talk focused on it as well, called The Real Reason You Feel So Busy and What to Do About It. And one of the studies that I point to in it, which I think is really interesting, is that some researchers at Columbia, Sylvia Bellezza and her colleagues, did a study that showed that, at least in American culture, and, you know, certainly some other ones around the world as well, but particularly here, busyness is a form of social status. And so part of the reason that we thump our chests so much about how busy we are is that it's essentially a socially coded, polite way of saying, I'm popular, I'm in demand, I am necessary. And, you know, it's something, you know, we all say like, oh, I wish I weren't so busy. But we keep making the choices that lead us here. And part of the reason the authors surmise that we do it is that we get a form of emotional validation from it. So I think realizing that, recognizing it, helps us kind of unwind it a little bit.
Yeah. We start to hear ourselves and go like, really, that just sounds ridiculous. Well, that's what I'm saying. Now I hear my son saying, I'm like going, ew, is that what I've sounded like all these years? Like, can I undo all those moments where I've said that probably three times a day to someone? You know, you get on a phone call, how are you doing? Oh, I'm so busy. It's so crazy. I'm like, oh, that's got to stop. So yeah, hearing it undoing it. But you make such an interesting statement, wow, about that sort of alignment and validation of our popularity because we're busy. I mean, you know, like I'd like to be like some people that I know that are not busy and working smartly and doing very well and don't need to say I'm busy all the time, you know, but I think yeah, a lot absolutely. Of us do that. It's such an interesting place and space to be. So the awareness of it is one thing. You know, can we put ourselves into a four-day work week environment, right? Can we get things done and allow ourselves the grace? I think the last 2 years have opened up the door to that conversation more than ever before. you know, even people working from home 1, 2, 3 days a week now instead of back in the office, you know, it's allowing for that human side of business, right? The flexibility, the acceptability of the flexibility, right? You know, what are you seeing in that shift?
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, I was just talking last night to a friend who is a location independent entrepreneur. He runs a company which used to have a physical office. He disbanded the physical office. Everything is totally virtual now. And he has a girlfriend who lives in another state, and the girlfriend's company makes them go into the office every day. And, you know, they only get 2 weeks of vacation. And so just the sort of, you know, this used to be normal, but now, especially this sort of extreme of like this guy who can kind of be anywhere he wants, and then his girlfriend who's stuck at an office, and even worse, it's an office in another state. It's like, you look at it and you're like, well, that seems primitive. And, right. And sure enough, you know, she's a very talented woman. She's looking for another job because she's like, wow, this sucks. I wish I could go travel with my boyfriend.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, Elon Musk notwithstanding, it's very hard to fight the tide of at least a hybrid situation, yeah, if not a purely virtual situation, because that people are voting with their feet and that is what they want.
I love that. That's so true. That's amazing. I have a fun question, and sadly, as we have to wrap this up, but sort of a fun question. If there were 3 or 4 really just interesting people that you would be able to have sitting at a dinner table with you, drinking a nice glass of wine and breaking bread and having a meal and interesting conversation, who might those people be? 3 or 4 people. They could be dead or alive.
Yes, yes. Well, I know there's so many good people that would be great to have dinner with. I would say, I would really like to meet Tegan and Sarah. They're like pop singers that I've really liked for a long time. And
love that.
I would like to meet John McWhorter. He is a Columbia University linguist. He now writes a regular column for the New York Times, and I think he is a very sensible, thoughtful voice in some of the blistering culture wars.
Wow.
And so I respect his perspective a lot. And if we're adding another one just for fun, yes, I would say, well, I've been watching The Crown a lot. So let's say Princess Diana. She just seemed so nice. I mean, you know, troubled girl for sure, but you know, good heart.
Good heart. Oh, completely. I actually had the pleasure of meeting her once.
Ooh, so how did you meet Princess
super
Diana?
Super cool story. My sister and I were manufacturing a product for the deaf and hearing impaired, a little vibrating alarm clock called Shake Awake. And we were at a show in London, in Brighton, actually, not in London, in Brighton, England, for the British Deaf Association, of which Princess Diana was a patron. And she came down for the day and actually got to meet her, give her one of our products, have a little chat with her. And I think the funnest thing about her was watching her just, you know, freak out her security detail as she sort of saw a little girl standing with a bouquet of flowers for her outside the building and sort of went off script and off the carpet and across the stanchions and kind of hitched up her skirt and sort of stepped over the stanchions to the little girl to take the flowers from her. And you know, you just watched her being so her, like, I don't care what the establishment says, I'm doing me. And it was just seeing that firsthand, just like, will always stay with me. I was like, and it was like the middle of the summer and she was the princess. And the one thing I noticed was she's not wearing pantyhose. She's a princess and she's wearing a skirt. but it's like 100 degrees out and she wasn't wearing pantyhose. And I just thought, that is so cool. She's just given permission to all these women who think they have to wear pantyhose to be proper with their skirts, yes, that they don't have to. And it was just very her. All of that was very her. It was very precious.
Oh, that's so great. Very cool.
Yeah, that's kind of my fun brush with Princess Diana. But I love that. Dori, this has been such an amazing conversation. I feel like you and I could really just go on for hours and hours and talk about all the nuances of what we're both seeing and dealing with and hearing and sharing and inspiring and hopefully motivating in others. So I'm really grateful to meet you, to know you, to have you be a guest on here. A shout out to Anat for connecting us. And I just want to really thank you. And we will include details on how to follow you and connect with you in the show notes. And for those who want to follow any of what we're doing at the Reinvention Exchange, just go to thereinventionexchange.com or follow me on Instagram. You'll find all the links and all the leads to everything you could possibly want to know or see or hear from all of our previous interviews or blogs or copies of our books. So thank you again, Dori. Any last words? Anything else you want to share?
Kathy, thank you. This is so great. And yeah, when you're next out with Magic Mike North American Tour, please look me up. That'll be very fun to connect. I'll just mention for folks who, you know, want to dive in further.
Please.
You had mentioned this at the outset, but I have a free long game strategic thinking self-assessment to help you apply the lens of long-term thinking in your own life. You can get it for free at doriclark.com/thelonggame.
Fantastic. And we'll put that in the show notes so everybody who's driving along or somewhere where they can't jot that down will have access to it. Dori, so fun to be connected, and I look forward to lots more conversations that won't be recorded and our new friendship. So thank you again, and have a great day, everybody, and happy reinventing. Thanks. Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to The Power of Reinvention. If you enjoyed this episode, please head over to iTunes to subscribe, rate, and review the show. Wouldn't mind a 5-star review. It would be greatly appreciated. Also, be sure to visit thereinventionexchange.com to share your reinvention stories, suggest a guest, join the newsletter mailing list, get access to my book, which is called Reinvent Your Life, What Are You Waiting For?, and discover fantastic bonus content with my blogs, and listen in to the Reinvention Virtual Chat series. Don't forget to join me next week for another episode. Please share with a friend, and thank you for listening. Happy reinventing.